Okay, hello colleagues, members of the public. I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Workforce Committee. Today is May 11th, 2015, and we have four bills to hear in a public hearing setting, and then we have two bills to be worked. And let me just say that if any of you are here for House Bill 2214, that's going to have to be carried over because we have not gotten an amendment back. So we'll start off with House Bill 3114. And Matt, could you tell us what that is? And John, could you come up while he's doing that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3114 allows injured workers to file workers' compensation claims within 90 days after a health benefit plan rejects the claim. The measure also requires health benefit plans to pay benefits in accordance with terms, conditions, and benefits of plan if workers' compensation claims are denied. This came through the House with no fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Thanks, Matt. John, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And with your indulgence, I asked Jeanette Holman, who's from the Insurance Division at DCBS, to join me in case there were any questions that she would be better prepared to answer than me. Under current law, we do sometimes have situations where workers have described not being able to access medical services as rapidly as I think all of us would agree they would need to, because there has been some confusion about which insurance coverage is going to cover the worker, either the health benefit plan or their workers' compensation coverage in the event when there's a claim filed. Last year, in 2014, House Bill 4104 was passed addressing the provisions of what we called interim medical benefits. And these are medical benefits provided to a worker during the time that the workers' compensation insurer is determining whether to accept or deny the worker's workers' compensation claim. If, under the law, the worker has a private health benefit plan, the bill required the health plan to provide some services while the workers' compensation claim was being decided, subject to that plan's terms and pre-authorization of services agreements. If the workers' compensation claim is accepted, the insurer or the self-insured employer pays back the health benefit plan and the worker for any paid medical services for accepted conditions, subject to the workers' compensation fee schedule. If the workers' compensation claim is denied, the health plan pays for medical services that are pre-authorized and subject to the plan's terms and conditions. In the wake of that House Bill 4104, health benefit plans found themselves prohibited from excluding work-related injuries or diseases if the worker is covered by both workers' compensation and a health benefit plan and the worker has submitted a workers' compensation claim that hadn't yet been accepted or denied. So that brings us up to today and House Bill 3114A. This bill addresses a slightly different situation. This is the situation when a worker has not filed a workers' compensation claim, but has submitted a claim to their health benefit plan, and that plan rejects the claim because they believe it is work-related. In that instance, under 3114A, the worker would have 90 days from the date of the health benefit plan's denial to go ahead and file a workers' compensation claim. And the reason there's a time frame on that is there's already existing time frames in workers' compensation law about how soon you must file your claim. In most instances, it must be 90 days after the date of injury, although under certain circumstances, it can be as long as a year. The workers' compensation insurer then has 60 days under the law to decide on the workers' compensation claim. If the workers' compensation insurer accepts the claim, they pay for the benefits based on the workers' compensation benefit and fee schedules. If the worker files a workers' compensation claim and the workers' compensation claim, and the workers' compensation insurer denies it, then the workers' compensation insurer under this bill must notify the health benefit plan of the denial. Under the bill, then, the health benefit plan is required to process the health benefit plan claim for payment subject to its plan's terms and conditions. The bill also clarifies that a worker's beneficiary, rather than a dependent, may provide the notice of an accident resulting in the worker's injury or death. Beneficiary in workers' compensation includes spouse and children, and that change is on page 1, line 6. The Management Labor Advisory Committee heard this bill, and they recommended it for you.
Thank you, John. Questions?
Yes,
Vice Chair Thatcher.
You mentioned some, okay, I was trying to track everything you were saying and absorb it. It was kind of going fast. But did you say that the law now is that a worker has 60 days to file a claim after a health benefit plan rejects the claim?
The law today, the way the law works today is workers are allowed to give notice of an accident or an injury to their workers' compensation insurer, typically at 90 days. However, there are some exceptions, including if the worker establishes a good cause for failing to provide notice of the claim within 90 days. Under those exceptions, they can have up to 1 year to file a claim under the current law. So a worker may be able to say, I didn't think it was work-related. I filed the claim with the health benefit plan. I eventually got notice from them that they thought it was work-related. As long as the worker then files within 90 days against his workers' compensation insurer today, they would be fine. And arguably, they could take up to a year to do that.
Okay. I guess I thought that's what we were changing here. So
What this does, the new bill, Mr. Chair and Senator Thatcher, is that when the health benefit plan notifies the worker that they are rejecting the claim, the worker has 90 days only from the date of the health benefit plan's denial to file their workers' compensation claim. So it's somewhat different, and there's different triggering dates that actually start the time clock running on these.
So this standardizes it a bit, or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Thatcher, I think what it does is it provides a remedy for both the health benefit plan and the worker now to have a way to ensure that the worker files workers' compensation claim when it appears to be the appropriate avenue for them to get their to get their health assistance with their health needs, and it ensures that the worker would have at least a 90-day period to go ahead and file that claim, not from the date of injury, which is the current law, but from the day they find out that the health benefit plan has rejected the claim.
Thank you. That clarifies it.
Right. So just to clarify it further, so what happens if we don't pass this bill? What is the exact problem with the current situation?
You want to help on that one?
And if you could introduce yourself. A little.
Sure. Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee, my name is Jeanette Holman. I'm a senior policy analyst for the Insurance Division, the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Currently, insurers are required, they cannot reject a claim solely because they believe it is work-related. That's something we changed in the rulemaking after 4104 passed, because some of them, if they thought it was work-related, they would just deny the claim, and the insured might not have recourse then to go into the workers' comp system. The reason we said solely is because they have to, in most cases, they can say to their insured, you need to file a workers' comp claim because we believe this is a workers' comp claim. And that's also kind of a trigger. But right now, they would file the claim. The insurance company would look at it and then potentially deny it. And those time periods, I'm not exactly sure what they are, but I think they're a 30-day after a clean claim is filed that they have to deny it. So you're using up part of that period of time when they can go against their workers' comp carrier. So this just gives them that extra time in case there's a delay with the insurance company, the health insurance company.
And Mr. Chair, if you would, I would just simply add that the two things that would be problematic is that if we don't pass this bill, then we're leaving open a potential transfer of care and cost to the health benefit plans that really belongs in the workers' compensation system. And secondly, workers wouldn't have that additional time of 90 days from the date that the health benefit plan denies the claim to file their workers' compensation claim. So they could find themselves precluded from either insurance coverage.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. Any further questions? Okay, thank you both very much.
We'll, thank you.
Get this bill scheduled for a work session for next week. Is there anyone else who wanted to speak on House Bill 3114? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on 3114. And let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3495. And while Matt is introducing, Rob Bovet and Steve Rodman can come up, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3495 provides for employers' employee contributions to pension programs and individual account programs of the Oregon Public Service and Retirement Plan to first be made for new members for wages attributed to services performed for the first full pay period following the six-month probationary period, without regard to when wages are considered earned for other purposes. There was a fiscal impact issued on the House side and no revenue impact. I should note as well that an amendment has been proposed for this bill at is the dash ones and should be in front of you.
Thanks, Matt. Steve, you want to kick this off?
Actually, Mr. Chair, it's Rob's bill.
Really? Okay. Hi, Rob.
Morning, Senator. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovet, Legal Counsel Association of Oregon Counties. House Bill 3495, its purpose is to clean up an ambiguity in the OPSERP statutes, not PERS Tier 1 or PERS Tier 2, but OPSERP. So the ambiguity revolves around the language in the statute relating to contribution start date, when the employer contribution actually starts. What makes it complicated is different employers pay on different pay dates for different reasons, for different purposes. And so throughout the years, there's been various directives and interpretations by both PERS and employers that are inconsistent with each other. So we've got employers all over the board. This creates kind of a mess. And so this proposal would clean it up in a way that makes it the same as essentially PERS Tier 1 and PERS Tier 2. We ran this issue by our committee at the
Employer Advisory Group. Talking about the Legislative Advisory Committee.
Yeah, Legislative Advisory Committee. I always forget the name, the LAC, at the PERS, which consists of union representatives as well as employer representatives, and we agreed that this is a fix that we really need to take care of in the statutes. It comes to you from the House side with no opposition in committee and no opposition on the floor, and we would strongly urge you to pass this out of committee with a due pass recommendation. I can't speak to the dash one amendments because I don't know whose they are.
Okay, that's fine, Rob. So just to have a better understanding of the problem and the inconsistencies that are out there, so a person, a new employee has a six-month probationary period, and then their next paycheck is when PERS contributions are taken out of or, are credited.
And the employer contribution.
In the employer contribution, right. And that's how it is for Tier 1 and Tier 2. And so is it different for OPSERP? Or Steve, maybe you could tell us.
Chair Dempro, for the record, Steve Rodman, I'm the director of PERS. That's exactly the inconsistency that this bill is trying to resolve. the testimony that we submitted shows you, for example, the what happens on a calendar month like March 2015, where the state, just as one employer, pays on the first of the month, unless the first is on a weekend, then you get paid the prior Friday. In that case, if an officer member completed their probationary period March 1, there would be no contributions until their April 1 paycheck. On the other hand, because April 1 falls on a Wednesday, somebody who completed their probationary period on April 1 would have their contribution start with that April 1 paycheck. So you'd have two members with two different start dates, both or with the same start date, even though they have different probationary periods. That's just what happens with the calendar because of the state. When you factor in local governments that pay across all kinds of pay periods, that bridge first of the month, the OBSERP standard that says their salary paid the first of the month is what's causing that inconsistent result. Reverting back to Tier 1, Tier 2 model makes the first full pay period after the first of the month subject to contributions. And that could be 2 weeks or a month, or depending on the employer's pay cycle, but at least it's a clear standard. So we think that the standard as the AOC has proposed to get us back to Tier 1, Tier 2 clarifies when members should first start contributing and employers should first start contributing for those members.
Consistency. Some people think it's overrated, but I think there's a lot to be said for it. Any questions? Okay. Steve, have you had a chance to look at the Dash 1 amendments?
Not on this bill. Sorry.
Well, we just got them this morning. I think they're recommending some major PERS modifications.
Is it Senator Knopes?
Mr. Chair.
Oh.
Yeah, those are mine.
Oh.
I could speak to those if you want.
Yeah, you might as well, since Mr. Rodman's here.
That'd be great. So essentially the Dash 1s are a redirect of the individual account program. And as we all know, on April 30th, the Supreme Court tossed out about 95% of the savings as it related to the PERS reform that the legislature did in 2013. And there are really only two or three things left that you can do. One is you could start essentially a fourth tier or 401k program, and I did testify as it relates to that in Ways and Means. The other two are a redirect of the individual account program and then dealing with the amortization rate of money match and the annuity. And so in the 2003 reforms, essentially what happened is we redirected the mandatory employee contribution from Tier 1 and Tier 2 members, which was 6%, away from the members' regular accounts and into what's called the IAP. And this reform slowed the growth of the regular accounts, resulting in two sources of cost reduction. Fewer active employees for whom money match would provide the highest benefit at retirement and a lower money match benefit for those who qualified. The employee unions challenged this reform in court, and in Strunk, the Supreme Court held that the PERS contract requires that money match be available as a possible higher-paying alternative to the full formula, but that the contract does not guarantee that the money match benefit will be maximized. So under the same reasoning, we should redirect the employee contributions into the PERS funds, which would deposit and estimated $600-plus million dollars per biennium into the PERS fund, which would consequently reduce the unfunded actual liability and at a proportionate level. And so I thought, taking the opportunity for the relating clause, I might just bring this issue up. Because, colleagues, I think we need to address PERS reform again sooner rather than later. One, because it's going to have a significant impact in the 17-19 biennium, and two, if we just got a decision from the courts on something that we did in 2013. So if we wait till 2017 to find out what else is legal as it relates to PERS reform, it's going to not allow us to, I think, maximize what we need to do in the 17-19 biennium budget. And so that's why I bring this amendment forward. I would be happy to have it in another bill. because I know the Senate President can. He has unlimited bill drafts.
I think Mr. Bovet would agree. He'd rather have it in another bill.
And I wasn't expecting necessarily to have this amendment adopted immediately into his bill, but I did think it was probably appropriate that we talk about it because I think it is likely a constitutional reform that could be done.
Yeah, thank you for that. And just to clarify, we don't have a work session scheduled for this bill, but you know, I thought it would be worthwhile for us to understand what it is. And I know this is something that was on the table last year or 2 years ago, and for whatever reason, it dropped off. But it was thrown out there as one of the things that perhaps could withstand a challenge. I don't know, Stephen.
Mr. Chair, if I could just comment briefly, and Senator Knope. Certainly would not want this in this bill for obvious reasons, but I also think it's not germane because we actually crafted a very narrow relating to clause. The relating to clause in this bill is relating to OPSERP, not PERS, so I don't think you could even do that in this bill, but I get the message.
Yeah, and legislative counsel drafted it for me and thought that it fit. So, but like I said, I'm happy to have Senate President give me another bill to do this in. So I'm perfectly happy there.
Okay, thank you. Steve, is there anything you wanted to say about it?
Chair Brent Denbrough, not having seen the Dash Ones, as described to Senator Knope, it's certainly, I think, another analysis, a round of analysis that we need to perform. We've already talked to other legislators about what might be left on the table and when and how we can ascribe a cost savings to those things. So we'd be happy to engage with the senator on any crafting that we can do to make sure that the concept can be administered by us. We understand what the direction is and come back to you at a later time with some direction as to what that might generate as cost savings for the system.
Great. Thank you. Okay. Thank you both very much. We'll get this scheduled for next week as well. All right, I'll close our public hearing on House Bill 3495. And since we are all here, let's take this opportunity to do a work session. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2664A. And Matt, why don't you remind us what this is, and then we can take a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2664A subjects universities with governing boards or not-for-profit organizations or other entities controlled by universities with governing boards to certain prevailing wage provisions of the Public Contracting Code and applies prevailing wage provisions of the Public Contracting Code to agreements with private energy entities to construct, reconstruct, renovate, or paint an improvement on real property owned by a university with a governing board or a not-for-profit that it controls. The measure becomes operative January 1st, 2016, and declares an emergency effective on passage. There was no revenue impact coming out of the House, and there was a fiscal impact, but it is a very short, somewhat indeterminate fiscal impact, and so it was not sent to Ways and Means as a result.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2664A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Thatcher has moved House Bill 2664A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Vice Chair.
I know I moved it, but I know this was part of the original deal. I just have some issues with the extra expense that is involved with the how the prevailing wages are set. And I actually have problems with the term prevailing wage because I don't believe they are actually prevailing. But that's my only issue. It's not about the deal that was set and that it was in, supposed to be part of that deal when they changed the individual boards. I understand that.
Right. And just for the record, colleagues, just to remind you that this, you know, prevailing, these projects would always have been come under the prevailing wage statute when we had an OUS system, and part of the arrangement when the boards were created and some of those responsibilities devolved to the boards was that they would remain under the prevailing wage statute, but that got left off in the conforming amendment, so this fixes that. But I hear your concern. Any further discussion? Okay. Is there any objection?
I'll just be an objection for now. Thanks.
Okay. All right. Vice Chair Thatcher is a no. The motion passes. I will take this one to the floor. Okay, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2664. Before we go into to our next bills, colleagues, since we're all here, I just want to say that we all need to give our committee administrator, Matt Germer, a big congratulations. He is a new father as of Friday.
Oh, boy. That's great.
Yeah, thank you.
When?
Thursday afternoon, my wife gave birth to our daughter, Elsie. Really excited.
That's
as her
exciting.
First child. She's a little early, only 30 weeks cooked, but she'll get to enjoy the NICU for a couple months before she comes home with us.
She here in Salem?
Hmm?
She here in Salem?
Up in at St. Vincent's in Beaverton. So, yeah, thank you.
Yes, it's great. This has been a tough time, and you probably had no idea because of how professional and competent Matt is. But it has had a very happy ending.
Thank you for putting that on the record so that I can later, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. All right. Let's move back to public hearings. We have two bills that I'm going to open simultaneously, I think, because they both have to do with the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board. We're going to try to refrain from the usual jokes around the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board, but these are two very necessary bills. So I will open public hearings on House Bill 2471A and House Bill 2472A. And we have Michelle Gaines and Chad Dresselhaus from the board, I think. Yes, tell us what these do, please, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2471A changes the qualifications to practice as a funeral service practitioner or embalmer, including qualifications related to reciprocity and training, and replaces references to apprentice with trainee, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage. There were no fiscal or revenue impacts coming through the House. House Bill 2472A allows the Mortuary and Cemetery Board to establish self-inspection programs to supplement the biennial inspections, and allows the board to set criteria through rule by which exempt operating cemeteries will not be subject to biennial inspections. The measure also repeals statutes on magistrate-issued warrants for inspection of facilities under board jurisdiction. Again, there were no fiscal or revenue coming out of the House.
Thank you, Matt. And I hear that there are some amendments that are being worked on these, so maybe you could also address them. Michelle.
Absolutely.
Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Michelle Gaines. I'm the Executive Director for the Mortuary and Cemetery Board. With me is Chad Dresselhaus, who will be speaking to the second bill. I'll focus on the first one. Both of the bills are a product of the annual community stakeholder planning sessions that the board put in place about 4 years ago to increase the involvement of the broad community, not only the licensees, but other interested parties with a stake in the services that we regulate. As part of that, we've developed a long-term plan of issues that have been prioritized with input from the community. On the handout that I distributed, it talks a little bit about that. Both of these bills are the result of input that was needing to be codified in some statutory change as part of accomplishing the goals of the overall community. This bill in particular, as far as the problem that we're trying to solve or the key drivers, one of the issues that disproportionately impacts regions outside the I-5 metro corridor is that for many of the aspects of the educational process, and to take the funeral service practitioner examination, you actually still have to come to our offices in Portland in order to take those tests. That is obviously a burden on many practitioners, so part of the language would loosen that up, if you will, and allow us to offer online testing. Right now, we offer them every couple of months. It would also enable us to do almost a just-in-time or an as-needed test, even if there's only one or two individuals. what we're seeing as far as trends is that there's a preference for individuals to want to stay in their local communities. Right now, the way it's set up is that they would have to sort of uproot for a bit and potentially move to another community, mostly in the Portland area, where there are apprentice or internship opportunities because of larger population densities, combined with some of the limits currently in statute, where a practitioner supervisor can only have a limited number of apprentices. That's one factor. We're also seeing, as far as trends, that there's an increase in an interest of the older workforce that may have had another career that wants to switch in to this field, believe it or not, and be a practitioner. There were some barriers that didn't seem to make sense. You could have a pathologist that had worked for 30 years with advanced degrees. If they wanted to serve as an embalmer in their local community, they would still, by statute, have to get a very specific associate's degree in order to then have that license. We want to remove that so that that's not a barrier. It is an aging workforce. The median age is 56, and it is something that historically had been a family tradition and has moved past that. But as you might imagine, it's not the most popular profession for individuals going in into the educational portion of their lives. And we're trying to broaden the opportunities for them into other areas, distance educations, other models for them to get involved in the community. And there had been some issues that were caused by larger gaps in unemployment, particularly in the last several years. We had some limits on if you had not worked in the field for a certain number of years, then you, in essence, had to start over, or if your experience was in a different state. So the essence behind the changes in this bill are all trying to deal with those problems that were raised to us through these planning sessions. One other piece that we wanted to do, which is a little more from the educational side, right now for the apprenticeship in particular, the assessment model is purely on being there for a certain number of hours and performing a certain number of cases. So there's no mechanism for an assessment on acquisition of or performance of a particular skill level. We're looking to move the assessment on that to a competency-based model, which would allow us to also provide folks that pick up the skills a little more quickly to serve a shorter apprentice, and for folks who need a little bit more time to be able to serve a little bit longer to achieve that within a maximum. So what the bill actually does, as Matthew indicated, there are a number of changes in here that are modernizing the language. They did remove some subpoena authority simply because it's very dated and it already exists for boards such as mine elsewhere in statute. So this would move us from the unique language to just using the same standard that the other health professional regulatory boards use. It specifically, there is also a change that the House implemented, which changes the term apprenticeship, which is an existing statute, to the term trainee. I do know that I believe there's opposition to that from at least one of the associations. And I have to say that some of my testimony, when I'm saying apprenticeship, it would be trainee in the current version of the bill. It allows tests to be conducted by a third party. We're a very small board. We can't provide that, but the statute says that we have to. This would allow us to retain a company that's an expert in that, and we would turn that over to them. It allows entry into the field for an embalmer for the qualified persons, as I described. It changes the reciprocity requirements, which is if you're in neighboring states and you have an equivalent experience and license, whether you can come practice in Oregon. It moves it to 1 year from 3 years. So you only have to have your equivalent licensure and a 1 year's of experience in order to come to Oregon, as opposed to before you had to have 3 years before having to do a process here. And we actually do have a lot of movement, particularly between Washington State and Oregon State. It removes the arbitrary maximum number of apprentices per qualified supervisor, and this is simply so that it can be based on what that particular supervisor can handle. And this addresses the issue where a particular location is currently limited to one individual that they can apprentice, which may be the only opportunity in a rural area, the only facility that could provide an apprenticeship, which then required any other persons interested to travel to another town, and quite often to Portland. Shifting assessment to competency-based assessment, and it adds clarifying language for responsibilities for supervisors and preceptors. We felt that was important, that if we're moving to a competency-based system, that we're very clear on what their responsibilities are and the qualifications for performing in that role. And it allows for internships to be served in Oregon from other schools in addition to Mount Hood Community College, or distance-based internships could be performed in the state as well. The amendments that we are requesting, they were discussed on the House side, but were not able to be brought in before the bill passed out. They're both corrective in nature. The first one is that there was simply the wrong statutory reference when it was originally written, so that gives it the right ORS number. And the second one is simply adding a word on page 4, line 24, adding the clause or exam, because right now it says that one question could be provided by the third party, so this would allow it either way. And with that, I thank you.
Okay. Why don't we ask questions about this bill, and then you'll talk about the other bill, right? Yeah. Questions about this bill? Yes, Vice Chair.
I don't know if you had an opportunity to hear some of the discussion on the House floor. I didn't, but I'm getting some sort of indication that there were concerns from more than one or two people, I guess, that this might make it more difficult to obtain a license to become a practitioner. What do you say to that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Thatcher, I don't believe so. I think some of the concerns are from the concern of what a competency-based program is. In fact, it is making it in many ways easier. There's greater access to the test. You don't have to come to Portland to do it. The points of entry as far as the amount of education that you need are the same. For reciprocity, it's much shorter. So the real difference comes down to this idea of assessing on skill rather than just a pure number of hours. But I wouldn't classify it as more difficult. I think it's more just an unknown quantity and a concern that it would be harder. The intent is for the competencies to be based on the criteria of what it takes to practice. So it'll be the same type of expectation of knowledge and experience that they gain out of an apprenticeship. It would just be assessed based on the skill rather than sort of coming up with a period of time that should happen in and a number of cases that it should happen in. I don't know if that addresses the question.
Yeah, I guess I'd be kind of curious what do most other states do in regard to this practice, I suppose.
Mr. Chair, Senator Thatcher, it is shifting to competency-based. In the discussions, this board is part of what they call the International Conference, which is the United States and Canada. And particularly the Canadian provinces, many of them have already adopted and are implementing and have been using a competency-based. Several of the eastern states are starting to look at this as we are. We'll be a little bit ahead of the curve as far as the Western United States, but it is definitely the way the overall industry is headed.
And I think if I could jump in, I think that's probably true of a lot of CTE areas, you know, that they're moving more in the direction of competency rather than seat time. The question becomes who sets the competencies and what is the process for that going to be?
Mr. Chair, currently what we're if the bill should pass, is we would set up a specific advisory committee that would be made up with representatives from Mount Hood Community College, any other programs that wanted to participate, the associations, members of the board, and probably we would seek, if the Mount Hood Community College don't have individuals who are knowledgeable and competency-based assessment in particular. Then we would draw from the educational community overall. They would make the recommendations on what they should be to the board, at which point we would begin the administrative rulemaking process and then adopt rules that define exactly what the competencies would be.
And the concern in the other chamber about the use of the term apprenticeship, was that because these aren't registered apprentices with the state, you know, the BOLI sort of process, is that, was that the concern?
I believe so. The use of the term apprentice has been in our statute since at least the 60s. I believe, though, that with the development of the registered apprenticeship program through BOLI, there was a concern that it would, since it's not one of those programs, that it would cause confusion.
Mm-hmm. Would there be any benefit for it to be a registered apprenticeship program?
We did speak with the folks from BOLI. It is not one currently that they were able to find an instance of for this profession anywhere in the U.S. So we will continue to work with them to see if it makes sense. They did not see a conflict, BOLI, when we spoke with them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we could at some point in the future change the name back to apprenticeship if that was appropriate?
As far as this board, yes.
Yeah.
That would be fine.
So the problem of, the bill allows professionals to take on more trainees, gives them that flexibility. Who determines, like, when enough is enough? I mean, you know, I understand that you're going to want to, perhaps in rural areas, you know, give more opportunities to a single professional, but, you know, at what point does that become too burdensome?
Mr. Chair, I think that's also, we would seek input for those exact limits from the experts by creating the advisory group. In general, we would look at their own performance as a practitioner and qualification as a practitioner in good standing. And then it would be somewhat situational in that. The other piece that this would do is not just the number that one individual could have, but because it's a one-to-one correspondence now of direct supervision, there are some communities where there aren't embalming facilities at all, and they may want to apprentice for part of what they would be to be an embalmer, but they would like to go, if they don't have enough cases in that community, to another community where they do have a case, but they would then, either the supervisor would have to go with them, or they would, they're unable to be supervised by a second individual for the purposes of supporting that one case. This would give us the opportunity to do that as well. So specifically, we would seek recommendation for a specific number, and we would also do some assessment on the supervisor process as well, their ability to properly assess.
Great. Thank you. And then finally, have you started thinking about how to guarantee security for the online testing, you know, to make sure that the person who's taking the test is the person?
The Mr. Chair, our current expectation is to use the same firm that actually provides the national embalming exams. We already outsourced that. The statutory language is written differently for the embalming exam than it is on the funeral service. So our intent is to contract with them to provide the funeral service side of it.
Thank you. Any other questions on this bill? Okay, let's move over to the next bill then.
Okay. For the record, my name is Chad Dresselhaus. I'm with the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. As Ms. Gaines discussed with 2471, 2472 was developed after several strategic planning meetings with industry, other interested groups. The main purposes of passing this bill is first to desire to increase licensee involvement and transparency, and tied with that is to provide hands-on understanding of the inspection process and facility requirements. I believe the intent of that is if licensees can self-inspect and understand the process, then that makes them less likely to violate in the future. if they know the process and can do it themselves, the likelihood of them being an expert in that and diminishes those possible violations. It also allows for risk-based inspection focus. Specifically, there are a number of pioneer rural cemeteries in the area that some haven't had an interment for 6-7 years. I believe one in a cemetery in Astoria. So those are the ones that are maybe less risk than others. So it provides opportunity and maybe some flexibility in that. What the bill does, similar to 2471, it modernizes the language, repeals certain sections that are a bit outdated in the language, and provide for other capability, or gives the board capabilities of it in other places. It allows the board to establish the self-inspection program, which is not to necessarily replace or required, but in the interim to allow for a kind of self-compliance to make sure they're doing the right thing. And also, it allows the exempt operating cemeteries possibly to, for the ones that have less activity, to maybe not be held to the higher standard as maybe the ones that are operating every day or that have more volume. The one amendment that we are requesting was initiated by our AAG. After reading it, he determined that, as written, it kind of negates the overall intent of the bill. So he suggested that adding the phrase "other than when performing a self-inspection" would satisfy the original intent of the bill. So thank you.
Great. So the self-inspections would happen on a regular interim basis. Is that what you're thinking?
Well, I think as with the other bill, a possible advisory committee could be created to determine that. But as of now, every 2 years, a facility is required to be inspected. So it could be on the off year. It could be different times, just depending on when it's felt to be necessary.
Great. Questions on this bill? Colleagues? Okay, thank you. So those amendments have been requested, have they? Or are we supposed to do that?
I think just through the committee, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll take care of it and hopefully have this ready for next week.
Great. Thank you.
Okay.
And congratulations,
Matthew. Thank you. So much sleep. Well, I guess we are.
He's gotten as much sleep as he's going to get.
Yeah.
For a while. So with that, I'll close our public hearings on House Bills 2471 and 2472. Colleagues, I think that's it. Okay, we are adjourned.